Jeffrey Tumlin is founder and president of several companies related to communication and leadership. His new book is titled Stop Talking, Start Communicating: Counterintuitive Secrets to Success in Business and in Life. He also holds a PhD from the University of Texas. Dr. Jeffrey Tumlin is on Sunday Journal. How are you?
I'm doing great, Hal. Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you and your listeners.
Jeff, it's great to get a chance to have you on here. And before we begin talking about the book, let's learn about your various companies, starting with Mouthpiece Consulting. Tell us about that company.
That's the company that I do my communication consulting work through. And usually what we do is we go into companies that are having trouble inside with how employees are communicating to each other or to customers. And we'll try to figure out the root cause of what's going on and see if we can work collaboratively with the employees in the company to try to make some improvements. So that's the communication company focused on helping people inside companies improve their communication with each other.
And who are some of these companies that you work with?
Well, quite a few companies over the years. I've done different communication and leadership consulting projects with companies. One of my very first projects was with Shell Oil. And over the years, I've been fortunate to work with some great companies like Wyeth, Boston Scientific. Had an opportunity to work with a bank that you may have heard of in New Orleans, Hibernia.
Sure.
And then they were bought by Capital One, and so I did a little work when they were Hibernia, and then I did a little work when they were Capital One. And those are different projects, not just communication projects, also leadership projects and presenting with some different classes and so forth with them. So I've done a lot of different work with companies like that, as well as very small companies, and many companies who nobody would have ever heard of. I hadn't heard of them before they reached out to me. But, essentially, no matter what type of company it is, the inside is the same in the sense that it's people trying generally to do a very good job. And when things go off track and we're able to lend a hand and get things working a little better, That's a nice, fulfilling part of the kind of work that I do for a living.
Jeff, you mentioned leadership, and one of your companies is called On Demand Leadership. Tell us about that.
The reason that there's two companies is because whenever you put anything into leadership, subsumes it. So we do have a communication specialty that I mentioned very early on, and in the book that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, it's about communication. And so I have a leadership company because I also, in my education, I went to the United States Military Academy at West Point, and so I started thinking about leadership in different ways there. And then I had an opportunity at the University of Texas to help a very, very nice gentleman who knew, who had forgotten more about leadership than I knew at the time. He kind of took me under his wing, and we helped build out a leadership center at the University of Texas. And so I ended up doing leadership work as well along the way, but needed to have two companies, because if you just run a leadership company, nobody will realize that the communication work stands on its own. It just kind of gets eaten and absorbed in the communication, in the leadership company. So both companies do similar type of work. The communication company does the work I mentioned before, and the leadership company helps organizations where they want to comprehensively help their people improve core leadership competencies, which are the things that you think they are. They're things like persuasion, motivating others, conflict resolution, and so forth. The things that leaders do, we help organizations help their leaders do those things a little better.
As I mentioned, we will get to the book here momentarily, but then we've got to learn about Critical Skills Nonprofit, and that particular company or organization provides communication and leadership skills training to underserved populations.
Right, that's the easy one. That's the That's the fact that I couldn't live with myself if I wasn't giving away the stuff I do for a living for free, at least some of it. I'm very fortunate to do what I love for a living. I do the leadership work, I do the communication work, and then both of those companies that make money doing that, we carve out a part of our profits to go to charity, and then we turn around and give away the very same services to either the underserved populations themselves or to organizations serving those types of individuals. That's just the thing that we do. It's what we should be doing. So that's the nonprofit.
Once again, our guest is Jeffrey Tumlin. He's author of the brand new book titled Stop Talking, Start Communicating: Counterintuitive Secrets to Success in Business and in Life. And let's go right to the introduction of your book, Jeff. It says that you wrote it because you believe that this is the best time in human history to be what you describe a competent communicator. Explain that.
What I mean by that, Hal, is that in the last 15 years, the ways that we've been able to connect to each other, and whether that's, you know, the fact that this phone in my pocket is now really more like a computer than a phone, or the fact that on a social network I can collect hundreds of my friends and contacts from my life and interact with them very easily, the ways that we can communicate with each other have changed dramatically in some wonderful ways, in some wonderfully powerful ways. And so my belief is that right now, this moment in time, it could be the golden age of communication, where people with competence and highly developed communication skills can flourish, have the kind of relationships they want, have the kind of life that they want, have the kind of meaningful connections that they want. The reason that I wrote the book is because that's the promise before us. But the golden age of communication, it remains frustratingly out of reach. And that same phone that I mentioned, it distracts me more than it connects me. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, my network on Facebook, they prevent me from getting important work done just as often as they enrich my life, and so on and so forth. And that's one of the core ideas that I wanted to convey, and the reason to sit down and spend the time writing the book is that, from my perspective as someone who's thought about communication now for over a decade, I'm not anti-technology. I'm not anti-digital device or digital tool.
I think I understand what you're saying. You'd like for us to have a good marriage between, I guess, sort of the old school way of communicating and marry that or make that work with the technology that we all utilize.
Hal, you hit it right on the head. My concern is that the balance is out of whack in the following manner. All day long, see, I'm human. I'm just like you, just like your listeners. I'm human. We're a shortcutting species. And what I've been given in the last 15 years are remarkable tools to simplify my communication. And that is exactly what I've done. And so I won't make a phone call. I'll send a text message. I won't talk to my wife, I'll shoot her an email even when she's in the next room. I'm taking shortcuts for easier communication dozens of times a day, and I'm concerned that all of us are losing our ability to do the more difficult communication behaviors that we need to do for life, such as knowing how to argue sensibly, knowing how to resolve conflict, knowing how to persuade people, knowing how to bargain, knowing how to get somebody to fall in love with me, and so on and so forth. These harder communication skills, I'm out of practice because from a communication perspective, all day long, I'm playing checkers, and then when I turn around and try to pull off a chess move, I wonder why it doesn't work. And that's my core concern with this moment in time. Too much quick and easy communication, and we're all of us falling out of practice with the more difficult communication skills that are important to the things we want to do in life.
Jeff, your book says that we're neglecting three vital communication habits, and you begin with listening like every sentence matters. What's involved with that?
Those three habits, and you mentioned the first one of listening like every sentence matters, that's the 30,000-foot view of aspirational. If we could just remember to pay attention to everything that people are saying, and it's aspirational, so you don't need to get perfect with this, but it was just my, of the 30,000-foot view for how to improve your communication, if you didn't do anything else that I mention in the book, but you only started paying attention and listening to every word, it would bring you enormous improvements. And so that's one third of the 30,000-foot view for how to improve your communication.
And then you've got another communication habit that you describe here. It says, talk like every word counts. And there you give an example of an encounter with someone named Neil. Tell us about that meeting.
So it's a true story. I changed the name a little bit and some details, but basically many years ago when I was working at a university, I had an opportunity. We hired a bunch of graduate students, and one person we hired, I didn't know much about, but my boss said, hey, hire this person to help us teach all these other graduate students. And so I got together with him. I had only about 2 minutes before our introduction where we were going to introduce him as a new member of the team to the other graduate students who were working with us. And I listened to his bio, I asked him a few questions, and I remember to this day, I was writing down a little biographical information about him on a note card, and then I put it in my pocket, I had to excuse myself, and I walked into the meeting, and he was there, and the other people were assembled, and after the formalities, I introduced him to the team, and it was, from my perspective, a regular introduction. I said we were glad to have him. I talked about his accomplishments. It turns out that the guy had a PhD, and he'd won a big essay contest writing about leadership, and he earned a month-long trip to Japan and so on and so forth. So I just did a regular introduction of the guy from my perspective. But at the end of the meeting, he came up, and there was something he had on his mind, and he said, hey, Jeff, you know, I want to talk to you for a second. I'm like, hey, okay, what's going on, Neil? And he said, I just wanted to tell you that nobody's ever said things like that before to me. And in my inside, I'm thinking, what are you talking about? I just introduced you and talked about what you did. You have a PhD. You've won this essay thing. We're delighted to have you. But I didn't say that. I just said, you know, we're glad to have you on the team. We value what you bring to the table. And now, fast forward, it's been 10 years since that moment. It turned out that that conversation triggered a host of other things in Neil's life. But basically, it was an epiphany. Sitting in that meeting with me doing what I thought was just a regular introduction, that guy realized that he was not taking enough risks for the kind of life he could have. And he immediately, quickly thereafter, he doubled down on the kind of risks he was taking, and he landed two enormous promotions. And right now, at this moment, we're talking on the phone, that guy runs the leadership program of a prestigious East Coast university. And he credits me. That introduction being a turning point.
Yes.
Yeah. And I never would have known. And that's communication. We never know when our words are going to make a difference, but if we acted more often like they could, that would be beautifully virtuous. And the flip side of that story is, just when I think I'm going to get everything perfect, Hal, and I practice everything, and I want to lay something beautiful on my wife, and I say it, and she says, yeah, okay, whatever, no big deal. That's communication. It's partly out of our control some of it. It's mysterious in that we can't predict what's going to happen, but we have to err more often on the side of thinking, what if every single word mattered? What if the next thing I'm going to say to my niece or my nephew and so on and so forth, what if that's going to be very important to them? And so that's where that second piece comes, and that's that story you were mentioning.
Once again, we're chatting with Jeffrey Tumlin, author of the brand new book titled Stop Talking, Start Communicating, Counterintuitive Secrets to Success in Business and in Life. And let's move on, Jeff, to the third vital communication habit, a life one interaction at a time. And there you talk about a CEO who was having a tough time on the job.
It's crazy. This was a number of years ago, and this person called me, and as I'm listening, basically said, look, I've never been richer. I have this, I have that, I have this, but my life has never been worse. But the people who built this company with me, and we put our blood, sweat, and tear into this, now it's almost like it's a nightmare to come to work. People aren't getting along. Can you help us in that sense? What he was asking for is, can you help make, because I asked him, I said, look, I always say to clients when, because I want to know, I say, if I had a magic wand, which I don't, but if I had a magic wand, what's the one thing that I could do for your organization? And in this case, this guy said, if you could just make it so that we enjoyed coming to work together again, that would be enough. We've got all the clients we need. We're having great success. Can you help us with that? And of course, there was a bunch of other stuff that we had to do, but in the end, we were able to really, it was just convening the group in that sense and helping them recalibrate their work environment. They had grown too fast, and the structure for how they were working hadn't kept up to speed. And so what he thought was people problems, it wasn't. It was that basically they were running a Corvette on a Yugo body frame, and they needed to take the Yugo body frame and put the Corvette body frame on this machine that had the big Corvette engine in it and so forth. And so we did that, and that helped to ameliorate the people problems.
And so, Jeff, a little bit more about that description in terms of, I guess, getting people to kind of maybe have one interaction at a time and focus more on individuals much more. Tell us a little bit more about that and how you help them improve on that particular vital communication habit.
So in that instance, what had happened is they had grown too fast, or not too fast, but they'd grown and had great success, but the structures for how they were talking to each other and the type of managers that they had, it hadn't kept up. And so too many of the core people were under great strain. Mm-hmm. And so what that meant in their day-to-day interactions is that they were consistently not at their best when they were interacting with their colleagues. And as you know from your own life at working at home, when you're under strain and you're not interacting at your best, things quickly spiral. And so part of what we did was we got the structure right. That was the first thing. They actually, in this instance, they needed to add new people. And so that helped take some of the load off. And then the next thing that we had to do is help get them refocused again on making every interaction count with each other, because people who'd known each other for 10 years had put together the last couple years of very counterproductive interactions. And so we had to unwind some of that to start making it again so they could accumulate day-to-day. Because the way in the real world, the way that we make things better isn't with one beautiful presentation. It's by showing up every day and being solid and dependable and being forgiving and being the kind of person other people can count on. And we had to start rebuilding that again in these relationships that had become frayed in the last couple years. But before we could just put the hocus pocus on it and go in there and say, hey, we just want you to be nicer, we actually had to fix the root problem. Mm-hmm. They needed a whole host of managers to come take the strain off. When we did that, then we could turn to the next step of helping those frayed relationships and helping them not add any more negative interactions to that body of work, that relational body of work, one to the other.
Jeff, let's go to the chapter titled Lose Your Friends, and there you outline what you call a pyramid prioritization system, and that is designed to help us to better manage our critical relationships. Tell us about that system.
Well, this, as I mentioned earlier, this sprung from many years ago when I was in my first year at the military academy. I suddenly found myself, after what I would describe as a fairly leisurely high school experience, I found myself at West Point, you know, way out of time and with a whole lot of things bearing down on me, you know, upperclassmen and the athletic department and the academic department and so forth. And I came home at the holidays and spent 2 weeks, a vital, critical 2 weeks off, and basically blew my time on people I didn't even know back in the day, and people who were marginally important, watching stupid movies and, you know, eating terrible food. And when I went back to West Point for the second semester, I realized, look, I'm an idiot. I can't believe that at the time in my life when I need critical, stabilizing relationships more than ever, I'm messing around and not attending to those 8, 9, or 10 critical relationships in my life. Parents, I only have one sister. I have a small number of aunts and uncles, and that number is shrinking. I've got a couple of real close friends and so on and so forth, and I needed something simple at the time, and what popped into my head was a pyramid with four levels. And basically, the people in the A group, that's my A team. It's my parents. It's my wife. It's a best friend or two. It's one or two critical people in my business world and a extremely small number of other people, and they totally have open access to me. And then there's a B group that's a level drop down, and they don't have open access, but I get back to them ASAP when they call me, even if I have to put them off a little bit, and so on and so forth. And the reason I called it Lose Your Friends is because of the idea that it's so easy for us to gather up friends and social media, and I'm not bashing that at all. But one of the things that the internet age has done is it's given everybody open access to us.
And we feel as though we have to respond to everything and everyone immediately.
Right. It's crazy. It's crazy because here's the thing. So not only are there too many people knocking at the door, so to speak, but the stuff that we think we need to respond to, it's mostly junk. It's my life. I wake up every morning and I have to fight the urge not to check my inbox. Mm-hmm. But my life strategy, it's not in my stupid inbox. It can't be, because life strategy, it's unified. It coheres around a theme. My inbox is a collection of disjointed, asynchronous communication messages. I can never, it's like stamps. That's like a collection of stamps coming in from all over, a stamp, a stamp, a stamp. When what I'm trying to build, you know, a Mona Lisa here. I can't build it out of stamps. And so it's crazy. You're totally speaking my language. I think about this stuff all the time. And then in my work, helping people and organizations, it's what, you know, the stuff that I wrestle with when I jump out in the morning and I think, oh, well, if only I can just check my email at, 6:30 in the morning, when I should be meditating, when I should be rolling through what my priorities are for the day and getting my mind around this major initiative that I'm a part of in somebody else's company, and they're trusting me to have the answers for. But instead, I want to get up and see what Groupon is in today. And, it's nuts, right? And we all fight it. And when I go and I work with CEOs, people who've worked their whole life and now they're in a position of these enormous responsibility, and they're doing the same thing. We're talking about, here's the future of the company. They brought me in. We've put in all this work. I tell the story in the book. I've put months into working with a company, having a major problem, multi-million dollar company, and I finally have the findings. And I brought it all. I brought it all to the table, and I've got these findings, and I know how we can fix this thing. It took me months. We spent a lot of money on this. I'm briefing the CEO, and his phone keeps going off, and we're talking about his legacy, and his phone goes off, and he's checking his email, and he keeps looking at the screen, and that's the frustrating part of this crazy, crazy digital age that we're living in. And the irony is, these same tools, back in the day, the first tool I got was a Palm Pilot. Why did I buy it? Because it said, oh, well, this will make you more productive, and it'll help you order your day. And now, the Palm Pilot's predecessor is this thing that looks like a phone, but it's actually a computer in my hand, and that's not helping me put my life together. That's, I want to stream Dexter and watch Dexter on this thing. You know what I mean? It's crazy.
That's
and it's
right.
Not because the trouble we're in with, the ancients knew how he or she who can harness their attention and focus, they're going to have more of what they want from life. And the crazy thing about the digital age, the trouble we're in, so to speak, is that we're not in trouble because these digital tools are bad. We're in trouble because how they could not be any more awesome.
Yes, yes. Well, I tell you what, Jeff, let's close out our conversation by focusing on the chapter titled Let Difficult People Win. And I found that to be very interesting. And there you present what you call the Zen of Quitting. And you actually use basketball coaching guru Phil Jackson as an example of this. And talk to us about this principle and what's unique about the way Phil Jackson employs it.
What I've always admired about Phil Jackson is that he never tried to jam his philosophy on his players, that he respected, Shaquille O'Neal for being Shaquille O'Neal, and Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Kobe Bryant. And I mentioned Dennis Rodman in the book as well. And he figured out, Jackson did, that these strong, dominant personalities, what I call, and in this book that you mentioned, this chapter, we're talking about difficult people, people who it's very hard to impose your will on. What Jackson figured out is, you know what? I think I'm just going to quit, and I'm going to go a little zen on these folks, and I'm going to let them be themselves and then figure out a way to work with that. And that's what I'm recommending in this chapter. We do not have an enormous amount of difficult people in our life, even though on some days it feels like we're surrounded by them. There's a relatively small number of people, very strong-willed or very forceful, there's a small number of these folks in our life.
And then when we're in a position of authority, we feel the need sometimes to want to be able to dictate to these difficult people.
And all I'm recommending is that in this chapter about respond with weakness, people ask me a lot of questions about it because it is provocative. But here's what I'm suggesting. When someone is truly difficult, pervasively, not just with you, not just on every fifth Thursday, because somebody just difficult with you, that's an interpersonal problem between the two of you. You need to iron that out. And somebody just having a problem every third Thursday, they're just having a bad day. But somebody who's pervasively stubborn or a big interrupter or extremely moody, whatever, with everybody, we're better off pulling a Phil Jackson and letting them be that way and trying to figure out how can I influence that person after letting them manifest their regular personality. Because we're not without influence. The thing that we do that's a mistake with difficult people is that we take it as a challenge. I'm going to get in there, and I'm going to figure out how to change this person.
Mm-hmm.
But a truly difficult person who is difficult with everybody, we're better off not entering that fight, but instead trying to see modestly, humbly, what might we be able to accomplish if we don't fight them on their turf